This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Coronavirus hard-hit India on Saturday received more international medical aid, this time from Austria and the Czech Republic. The aircraft arrived in New Delhi ahead of virtual talks between the 27 leaders of the European Union and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Meanwhile, the German ambassador to India says an oxygen plant brought in by Germany to the Indian capital is almost up and running. He says the plant can make 400,000 liters of oxygen per day. India has seen a record surge in COVID-19 cases in recent days, with hospitals in the capital and across the country turning away patients after running out of medical oxygen and beds. The European Union and India have agreed to restart their negotiations on a free trade deal. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi spoke via video conference to EU leaders attending a summit in Portugal on Saturday. The two sides announced what they called a pivotal moment in their relations by agreeing to resume talks they gave up on in 2013 and to collaborate on a wide range of other issues. Plans for a face-to-face EU-India summit fell through due to the pandemic surge in India. Modi's remote appearance was the first time an Indian leader participated in a meeting with all EU leaders. Afghan officials say multiple blasts at a girls' school in the Afghan capital Kabul on Saturday killed at least 40, including many young students, and hurt dozens more. Footage on TV channel Tolo News shows chaotic scenes outside the school, with books and school bags strewn across a bloodstained road and residents rushing to help victims. Kabul is on high alert since Washington announced plans last month to pull out all U.S. troops by September 11th. This is VOA News. Israel is bracing for more protests Saturday, a day after clashes near a Jerusalem mosque injured more than 200 people, and as the U.S., EU, and regional powers call for calm after days of escalating violence. In the unrest following Muslim prayers on Friday, Israeli riot police fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades at Palestinians who hurled back rocks, bottles, and fireworks. Israeli police say 17 officers were hurt, while a Palestinian humanitarian group says 205 Palestinians were injured in the violence at the mosque and across annexed East Jerusalem. Video footage showed Israeli forces storming the mosque's sprawling plaza and firing sound grenades inside the building where worshippers, including women and children, were praying on the last Friday of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Madagascar on Saturday received its first batch of coronavirus vaccines through the COVAX Global Sharing Program, one of the last countries in Africa to get the prize jabs following months of resistance by its president. While countries across the globe scrambled to secure doses of precious COVID shots, Madagascar's president, Andre Rajoelina, showed little interest and instead promoted a locally brewed herbal drink as the only required coronavirus cure. But an infection resurgence last month forced the president to agree to a vaccine rollout. A first shipment of 250,000 AstraZeneca jabs landed at the Indian Ocean island nation on Saturday. Chadian security forces fired tear gas at protesters who took the streets of the capital on Saturday to protest against a military takeover that followed the death of President Idriss Deby on the battlefield last month. Chad's transitional military government had a day earlier banned the protest called by some opposition parties. That didn't stop groups of protesters from taking to the streets on Saturday, chanting and waving flags, while others held printed messages denouncing what they called a monarchy. One activist says police clashed with those who resisted and there were injuries. And China's foreign ministry said on Friday that debris from a rocket will burn on reentry and is highly unlikely to cause any harm. European and U.S. space tracking agencies predict remnants of the large Chinese rocket will plunge back through the atmosphere to Earth late Saturday or early Sunday. The U.S. military calls it a so-called uncontrolled re-entry and says it's being tracked by the United States Space Command. Pieces from a Chinese rocket rained down on the Ivory Coast 1 year ago, damaging several buildings. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We're not expecting anything different from them. This is how they are wired. This is how they talk. And most regimes that are going down or that have gone down in the world have also had the same arrogant attitude towards popular call for the president to step down.
A Nigerian activist launches a social media campaign saying President Muhammadu Buhari is not resolving challenges facing the country.
Tamia was more diplomatic. She put on mask when she visited Kenya. It was more diplomatic rather than the reality, because when she comes back to Tanzania, she has not been insisting on people to put on masks as one of the methods or measures to protect against COVID.
Political analysts say the Tanzanian president's recent foreign trips are successful.
And we want to follow up with Congress, and we want a resolution on the table. We want a congressional hearing specifically on Uganda, and we also want to know where does Congress stand after the State Department issued a statement earlier this year that the elections of January 14th were neither free nor fair.
And a group embarks on a protest while calling on the U.S. Congress to impose sanctions on those responsible for gross human rights violations in Uganda. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria, a former presidential candidate has launched a social media campaign calling on citizens to support a vote of no confidence in the leadership of President Muhammadu Buhari. Omoyele Sowore, who is also an activist, says the president has failed his core constitutional duty to protect life and property. He cited high youth unemployment as well as ongoing insecurity challenges, including banditry, the kidnapping of students, and violence carried out by Islamic militant groups like Boko Haram. All of this, he says, is clear evidence that the president appears incapable of governing effectively. But supporters of the government rejected both the criticisms and the social media campaign. They say Sowore is trying to relitigate the last election he lost to the president. They call the campaign a publicity stunt aimed at keeping him relevant. For more on his campaign, I reach Omoyele Sowore in the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
We are calling for a vote of no confidence to be passed on President Muhammadu Buhari of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, because since the end of the Civil War in 1970, this man has overseen the worst insecurity to face the Nigerian nation. He has also overseen the worst economic policy and direction for the Nigerian nation. To the extent that at this point that I'm talking to you, Nigeria is printing naira, and the value of the naira continues to go down. There's massive unemployment in the country. People cannot afford to eat. Salaries of workers are not being paid. And President Buhari just doesn't care. He runs the country through proxy by people we refer to as the cabal, and they engage in massive corruption. I mean, massive, massive corruption. Nigeria has become the global capital for kidnapping as we speak. It's become the global capital for banditry. It has become one of the worst, most terrorized nations in the world, second probably to Afghanistan. It is time for President Buhari to be kicked out of office, to be asked to leave, and we are going to start a series of action beginning with this public call for a vote of no confidence on the president by the Nigerian people.
Will this campaign only be on social media platforms? Because I have seen your Twitter feed and people are retweeting.
The campaign has just started, and our goal is to start it by creating awareness on social media. I'm not in a position to disclose how far it will go, but I think pretty soon it will involve all the stakeholders in the country coming together and putting their boots on the ground to enforce the outcome of this campaign.
Well, Mr. Sowore, the government issued a statement saying that there are plots by some misguided elements to wreak havoc on the government, sovereignty and corporate existence of the country. With your latest social media campaign of a vote of no confidence in the president, wouldn't you be following suit and basically be among those who want to wreak havoc on Nigeria?
They are the ones who are encouraging terrorism, and the country, one of his ministers had been outed as a terrorist sympathizer, done nothing about it. They are the ones who refuse to safeguard lives and property, and they are the ones mistreating Nigerians, and Nigerians just can't wait. They can say whatever they want, and they can tell the world whatever they want that someone is trying to wreak havoc on Nigeria, but it's Buhari that's wreaked the most havoc in Nigeria. It is the right of Nigerians to look him in the face and say to him, we're tired of you, we're tired of your failure, and we're tired of your system of government. We're tired of this holistic, disastrous style of governance. They have a right to do that.
Well, Mr. Sowore, what do you say to supporters of the government who are of the view that some of you are trying to rewrite what you couldn't do by defeating him in the 2019 elections, and that because he won, people are being recruited from ethnic lines just to destabilize the country? What do you say to that?
What the government is trying to do is to intimidate people, to bully them and harass them by blackmailing them with this destabilization alarm. The country is currently completely destabilized. Everywhere is in turmoil. So don't let anybody fool you with this whole blackmail about destabilization. What we're trying to do by passing a vote of no confidence on his leadership is to reestablish some form of order and, you know, the power of the people to regain, you know, dignity and integrity of Nigeria, nothing more.
What are the prospects of success? Because some supporters of the president, and for that matter, the ruling party, are saying that you should be dismissed and that this is just a social media gimmick or a stunt just to make yourself relevant. What do you say to that?
Listen, I've never seen any terrible regime before in the world that didn't have supporters, including Hitler. So you expect people who've get crumbs from the tables of the current failed regime led by President Muhammadu Buhari to defend their source of food. So we're not expecting anything different from them. This is how they're wired. This is how they talk. And most regimes that are going down or that have gone down in the world have also had the same arrogant attitude towards popular call for the president to step down.
Omoyele Sowore is an activist and a former presidential candidate. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Political analysts in Tanzania say the recent trips of President Samia Suluhu Hassan to neighboring Kenya and Uganda has been a success. The president first went to Uganda, where she signed a major oil pipeline deal with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. The Tanzanian leader says once completed, the oil pipeline will create over 10,000 jobs. She followed the Ugandan trip up with a two-day state visit to Kenya. In Kenya, she met with President Uhuru Kenyatta to resolve an impasse that stalled the importation of maize. She also held trade, diplomatic and bilateral talks with her colleague before addressing the Kenyan parliament. Her speech, analysts say, was a welcome departure from her predecessor, the late President John Magufuli. For a closer look at the Tanzanian president's trip to Uganda and Kenya, I reach Faraja Lugome, lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Yes, it is a success, and it has shown immediate results as the President Uhuru announced to allow the maize that were stuck on the border to enter the Kenyan market. There were the business people from Tanzania were transporting maize to Kenya. And for too long now, the cargo was seized or was stopped at the border with excuses that it was unfit for human consumption. But later on it was learned that there were some politics on the business. And so President Uhuru has ordered the Minister for Trade, he has given him two weeks to make sure that the maize has entered the Kenyan market. So that's one of the achievements or the success of the trip.
Now, with this latest move, do you expect relations between Dodoma and Nairobi to be strengthened based on the visit by Samia Suluhu?
Yes, but sometimes we become skeptical, even though the environment might change. The relationship might be bolstered, might be improved in future, depending on the continuous political will on both sides. As you can recall that even during Jakaya Kikwete, there were several efforts to smoothen, to make the icy relations that existed between Kenya and Tanzania to be improved. Yes, there were several efforts made. But unfortunately, some of the elites or some of the politicians in Kenya have been reluctant to allow or to implement what has been signed by the president. That's my worry. And that has been existing for so many years.
Well, Faraja, some people are of the view that it was important for President Hassan to make the move to visit Kenya because the trade balance always seemed to favor Tanzania. So it is in the best interest of Tanzania to make the move to smoothing relations with not only Kenya, but Uganda as well. And partly that she has a work to do to smoothing relations in the East African community. How are people reacting to this?
People have shown to be so positive about the move because, Tanzania has been producing a lot of agricultural crops whose market is mostly in Kenya. We are producing at the back, and we don't have markets to sell our crops. So Kenya has become one of our important marketplace for our crops. And so by smoothening the relationship between Kenya and Tanzania, it means the president has now done a good step to allow for the markets for the markets for Tanzanian farmers to sell their crops to Kenya. So that's one of the important things.
On social media platforms, a lot of people are saying that back home, the president does not wear face mask covering at home. But when she goes to visit other nations, including Kenya and Tanzania, she covers her face. And they're wondering if she has changed her stance on the situation of COVID in Tanzania. Why is she wearing face coverings in Tanzania to send a strong message at home that people should protect themselves? What is your take about that?
Yes, and Peter, you can recall one of our interviews in the past. I said, yes, President Samia might take some strong measures against COVID, but I wouldn't expect to be stronger by allowing social distance, even though the Minister of Health has released some guidelines on protection against COVID. But Samia was more diplomatic. She put on mask when she visited Kenya. It was more diplomatic rather than reality, because when she comes back to Tanzania, she has not been insisting on people to put on mask as one of the methods or measures to protect against COVID. So I think, to me, I take that as more diplomatic than realistic measures against COVID in our country.
Faraja Lugome is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A group of Ugandans in the diaspora is calling on the U.S. Congress to impose sanctions on those responsible for human rights violations in the East African country. The group petitioned lawmakers to impose targeted sanctions, saying they will serve as a deterrent to senior government officials in Kampala. Their calls follow the group's protests at the offices of Mercury Public Affairs, a public relations company in Washington, D.C., Friday. They were protesting the recent agreement signed between the Ugandan government and Mercury. They say the contract enables Mercury to lobby the authorities in the U.S. to, quote, whitewash the image of the government in Kampala, which the group accuses of engaging in gross human rights violations back home. But supporters of the government reject the accusations. They say the Ugandan government is simply protecting life and property and will not allow opposition groups to undermine the country's stability or threaten its territorial integrity. Karim Ntambi is the organizer of the protest. He tells me that it is unacceptable for the government in Kampala to use state institutions, including the judiciary and the police, to crack down on opponents.
So we are here at the offices of Mercury Public Affairs, one of the major lobby firms for dictator Yoweri Museveni. We decided to do this because Museveni, after getting too much pressure from the people in the diaspora, he decided to hire a new, bigger firm, which is Mercury. Mercury has also been representing other repressed regimes on the continent of Africa, including Cameroon, Zimbabwe, and Rwanda. So we are here to send them a message that it is not fair for them to be taking money from the plates of kids who are starving in Uganda into, you know, feeding their lifestyle there in Washington. We are here to send them a message that, you know, working with the dictator is unsustainable. They should stand with the people of Uganda. They should recognize the gross human rights abuses that are going on in Uganda and say something about it.
But Karim, some people are suggesting that Mercury is just an independent organization or business that operates here in Washington, D.C., and they are free to do or consult with anybody they can consult with as long as they abide by the laws here in the U.S. Why shouldn't they do their business because you don't like it?
No, it's not that we don't like it. The ambassador of Uganda a couple of days ago had an interview with one of the newspapers about them enlisting Mercury, and he said the reason why Mercury was hired was to do public relations for the regime. Given the recent gross human rights abuses, given what we saw during the January 14th elections, pre, intra, and after the violence that was subjected to local people in their respective villages, we documented that as the diaspora. And given that the international community has been changing its stand on what's going on in Uganda, and they are considering, especially here in Washington, they are considering to review the U.S. partnership to Uganda. So with that, Museveni felt the need that he needed to hire a bigger firm that has contacts within the capital, has contacts within the news media, has contacts within the business community here in Washington to make sure that, you know, they rebrand the repressive regime of Yoweri Kaguta Museveni. So that's why probably we are here at Mercury.
Karim, some people are suggesting that if Ugandans in the diaspora here in the Washington, D.C. metropolis have any problem, it should be with the administration in Kampala and not an independent PR firm that is just doing its job.
It would have been the work of the embassy to represent the interests of Ugandans. However, the government of Yoweri Museveni since 2015 have spent millions of U.S. dollars on lobby firms. Not only Mercury Public Affairs, they have been working with Scribe Strategies and advisors who had signed a contract of $250,000 a year. The contract that has been signed with Mercury is a month-to-month basis, which means they can always reconsider. For them to decide that they will have this contract going on, it is really inhumane. It makes them accomplices, as I said earlier, to what's going on in Kampala.
What is next after this protest?
After here at Mercury Public Affairs, we are going to send a message to Congress, and we have about four major asks. One is to review the Uganda military partnership that has been going on, that the government of Uganda has been perhaps using to cover gross human rights abuses. We have seen, you know, over a time that the people who have been responsible for gross human rights abuses, especially those in the army, have always been cleansed by what is going on in Somalia. For example, when General Peter Ewelu commanded the massacre of people in Kasese in 2016, he was shipped to Somalia to work with AMISOM. And ever since then, his work with AMISOM makes him cleansed. He will never be held accountable. The second reason is to ask Congress to follow up with the State Department and invoke GLOM has targeted sanctions on those who have been responsible to abusing gross human rights in Uganda. The other reason is to follow up on the 116th Senate resolution that had been tabled by Senator Bob Menendez, who is the Senate Foreign Relations Chair. He had tabled a resolution specifically on Uganda, and we want to follow up with Congress, and we want a resolution on table. We want a congressional hearing specifically on Uganda, and we also want to know where does Congress stand after the State Department issued a statement earlier this year that the elections of January 14th were neither free nor fair.
Karim Ntambi is the organizer of the Ugandan diaspora protest. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, the Ugandan Journalists Association is calling on the government to stop the security services from attacking reporters and other civilians. The group says the police and the military routinely attack journalists who are simply carrying out their duties to cover activities of the opposition. Their call follows the release of the annual Freedom Index report issued by the Human Rights Network of Uganda. The report shows that the police and the army are among those who violate the rights of citizens. It adds that the police committed 104 out of the 174 cases of human rights abuse documented by the organization, while the military is accused of committing 31. This prompted the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, to call on the judiciary to expedite the delivery of justice for 35 journalists who it says were attacked for covering the political activities of the NUP. The party adds that the journalists have yet to be compensated, while those responsible have not been held accountable. For more about the call by the human rights groups, I reach Matthias Rukundo, president of the Ugandan Journalists Association.
Ugandan Association is one of those associations that are already in court, and some of the people mentioned in that regard are our members, and our matter is coming up for hearing on 22nd May. I believe having a second voice to collaborate our voice, that we had put the issue to the public to support our idea, I think it is a good idea. I appreciate the efforts by NUP to add a voice to that has been existing by UJA. I think it's a good gesture, and they have no option but to hear our matter and in a fair way that can deliver justice in the best way possible to the journalists.
Has your organization also petitioned the judiciary in expediting justice for some of your colleagues?
We've interfaced with different players in the judiciary, including the registrars and all those. And we asked them to consider the matters of journalists, human rights, and all that attaches journalists to be a matter of urgency. And we are glad to report that after those several engagements, our matter was fixed for hearing on 22nd May, like I had mentioned earlier. So we believe we are not using only one way. We are using different platforms, different layers to make our case heard very easily and possible. So we've made engagements. We've asked them. When we were celebrating the World Press Freedom Day, we echoed the same requirement, we echoed the same message, asking the public, asking the judiciary, and all the entire players to make it a reason enough that the issue of journalists' rights as a matter of urgency on all platforms, whether court or whether in parliament, we're asking that we must be given a fair ear and a fair way and a process that can deliver justice without fear of sort.
Well, a Press Freedom Index annual report released by the Human Rights Journalist Network of Uganda basically cited the police and the army as topping the list of media freedom violators. What is your position about this?
For the last 7 years, the two agencies of government have been topping that chart. So we believe these are indicators that the space for free media is shrinking on everyday basis. So we're asking government and all the players of government to take up the challenge and resist from really going ahead to violate the rights of journalists at all levels and all the time. So it is an indicator that the space for media is shrinking, but we are not seated. We are making efforts. We want to use the process of law to enforce our rights in all ways possible as the practitioners of journalism in Uganda.
Some people have expressed concern that the recent utterances by the Inspector General of Police, Mr. Martins Okoth-Ochola, turning down demand by the media to have the institutions apologize for assaulting them, the police, or basically beat journalists to protect them from harm. What do you make of such an assertion from the Inspector General of Police?
We were shocked. We were disappointed. We were worried. But we were confident because we held a press briefing thereafter. We wrote to him, calling him to order. We also asked that he apologizes. I think he appeared before the legal parliamentary committee and he apologized to the public. But I think the body language and all actions thereafter do not suggest that he is remorse, he's regretful. So we think it is a bad method, should be highly be condemned by all human rights defenders. And most importantly, we are taking it as an issue and we are making ways possible to gather evidence as an association for journalists, because we had given him time to apologize and show remorse. And I think he has failed on his part. We think it is a bad statement more, a bad statement from a leader holding an office in the trust of the public of that level to make such comments about people's rights. The rights for journalists are enshrined in the Constitution of the Republic of Uganda, but also in other acts like the Press and Journalism Act of 1995. So we believe our Chola should be called to order by the powers that appointed him. We had actually suggested in our petition to him that if we deem that he's not competent for this office, should resign immediately, because it is unheard of that a leader of a police force that has been indicated in all reports, index reports for journalists, and all other reports that are made by human rights defenders, police and the army tops the chart. So for him to go ahead and make such comments, it is a disappointment to the state, it is a disappointment to the citizen of Uganda, it is an indication of the shrinking space for human rights, not only for journalists, but also for the entire Ugandans. So we must fight and defeat the insinuations of all those nature.
Mathias Rukundo is the president of the Ugandan Journalists Association. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Zambia, civil society and press freedom groups are demanding an investigation and prosecution of supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front, or PF, for attacking two journalists. The reporters were covering the decision of Chishimba Kambwili, a prominent opposition figure and leader of the National Democratic Congress, NDC, to rejoin the governing party. The journalists were attacked following clashes between supporters of Kambwili and the PF at the event in the capital, Lusaka. The attack left the journalist injured, with one of the two needing immediate medical attention for an eye injury. The groups expressed concern about politically related violence in the run-up to the August 12th presidential and legislative elections. Felistus Chipako is the vice chairperson for the Media Liaison Committee, a group supporting journalists. She tells me that politically related violence is unacceptable.
We didn't take it kindly, and it was an issue of grave concern, because it means that we are not safe, and we need to ensure that journalists are very well protected from whatever fracases are happening.
Some journalists have expressed concern that politically related violence could be at the doorsteps of these journalists covering these political rallies in the run-up to the election. Does your organization share those concerns?
Yes, definitely. We do share our concerns. The Media Liaison Committee is an organization that is basically looking out for issues that concern journalists. And violence is very high on our agenda, because we have seen a rise in violence against journalists by political parties, whether it's the ruling government or whether it's the opposition. So that is top of our agenda. And we're trying as much as possible, calling on government, even recently during the World Press Freedom Day, that was one of the issues that we raised with the president who graced the occasion. So that is top of our agenda. We are very concerned.
Are you satisfied with the level of cooperation for all the political stakeholders in the run-up to the election to ensure the safety of journalists, particularly with activities leading up to the elections?
No, we are not. It's an issue that is ongoing, and we're very concerned, and we are trying to, by all means and by all areas, trying to find ways and means, and also voicing out on this issue of violence against journalists. So we're calling. We keep singing. It's a song that we'll sing until August 12th, and we're trying by all means possible and looking at all political players concerned, whether the government or whether the opposition, we are calling on all of them and looking closely at this issue and monitoring each and every aspect of it.
How does the organization plan to engage political parties and other stakeholders to ensure that their supporters do not engage in acts of violence during the election process?
First and foremost, we have been having meetings with stakeholders like the Zambia Police. The Zambia Police held a workshop recently, and our chairperson was actually invited to give a presentation and speak out on the issue and voice out. And also, like I said, the Bloggers Association of Zambia is a member of the Media Liaison Committee. They had started this process of going around the country and engaging and enlightening the police on issues concerning safety of journalists during the elections, the run-up to elections, and even after the elections.
A lot of criticisms have been leveled against the police of being biased, and that its mandate to protect life and property sometimes are not properly carried out. How do you get commitments from the police in your engagement to ensure that they protect citizens and prevent some of these violence from happening during the election process?
I think the engagements that we've been having through workshops, through discussions, and through invitations by the police service themselves to engage us regarding violence against journalists is a good step forward. But basically, the concern is still there, Peter, because we have seen instances where even when the police sit by and watch journalists being violated or being harassed. So I think this is a continuous process which we will not let go of, and we'll continue engaging and ensuring that the journalists are protected. And even during the World Press Freedom Day again, I said we called upon the president to actually ensure that, as a commander-in-chief, to call upon his police service to ensure that journalists are protected.
So what is your group's message to journalists and to all the stakeholders about ensuring there's no violence during the electoral process?
Our appeal is all stakeholders and all citizens concerned and all political parties concerned must realize that journalists are merely doing their duty to inform the nation. And so it's very important that we are given room to work without intimidation, without violence, so that people are well informed and are able to make informed decisions, especially regarding the issue of elections. So that's what the NLC is calling out to everybody, and to ensure that at the end of the day we have peace and tranquility in our nation.
Felistos Chipako is the Vice Chairperson for the Media Liaison Committee, a group supporting journalists in Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Malawi, a businessman and former refugee is calling on the government to give refugees enough reasonable time to decide their next line of action. Eli Umakunzi says it is unfortunate and regrettable for the government in Lilongwe to order refugees who have been integrated into Malawian society to move to the country's only refugee camp. Refugees have often complained about overcrowding at the Zaleka camp outside the capital, Lilongwe. The camp, which was originally designed to hold about 14,000 refugees, now holds about 50,000. But officials have expressed concern that the administration might not be able to effectively protect those living outside the camp. The government wants refugees owning businesses outside the camp to return and continue with the activities. He adds that those who have married Malawians should apply for residency permit as the laws stipulate. But Eli Umukunzi tells me that most of the integrated refugees living outside the camp are uncomfortable with the government's order to move to the overcrowded Zaleka camp.
Just on the evening before the actual deadline to relocate these refugees to a camp that is already overcrowded, over-congested, the government had done this directive to relocate all refugees. And the reasons for this were twofold. The first one was because of security reasons. And the second one was because of the Malawian constitution that actually says that all refugees must stay in camps.
Homeland Security Minister Richard Chemwendo says that they are not chasing the refugees. They just want them to be where they are supposed to be in accordance with the constitution. Why do you think this is wrong?
This is wrong because of the fact that many of these refugees have been received in the past years and past decades, actually, documents to be self-reliant outside of the camp. So these refugees have houses, have children that have integrated the school system outside of the camp. And many of the refugees are married to Malawians. So once you relocate these refugees, it means that you're actually separating families, separating men and wives, and also children. For us, or for also many of the human rights activists and associations, this was not right. And also according to the court that put an injunction on this directive.
But the government wants those who are engaged in business activities to operate from the camp. And that if the refugees are married to Malawians, to apply for permanent residence, just like it happens in anywhere else. Why are you opposed to this?
It's not a question of being opposed. It's a question of humanity in the end, because when we talk about the camp is a camp that is already over-congested. It's a camp that can only accommodate 10,000 people, and they wanted to put 50,000 people there. And the fact that what you mentioned about applying for permits and so on, it's not that evident, because these refugees don't have other documents than actually the UNHCR documents. So they cannot apply like any expat or any investor like me. So this was very difficult to en route these people in 14 days, because initially it was just 14 days that was given to these refugees. So to en route them from their communities, which they had been contributing to, and in 14 days to leave everything behind and take children from school, this was at least unfair.
What do they plan to do next, now that they seem to have a little reprieve based on the injunction placed on the government by the court?
So the main thing is that most of these refugees, they just want reasonable time, because, like I said, 14 days or 28 days to leave everything behind that we had worked hard for. What they want is a reasonable time. If they have to go, if they have to leave and flee again into other countries, or if they have to go to the camp. But like I said, the camp is not really an option because it's already over congested. And with this COVID-19 pandemic that is present everywhere, and especially also in the refugee camp that is already over congested, no one would bring their family there. So these refugees just want a reasonable time, whether it's 6 months, 1 year, a reasonable time for them to sell any assets, to relocate their families, and to go to other countries, because as refugees, they are well aware, they have this experience, at least they have this experience of fleeing and having to leave countries behind or their homes behind. But at least as a law-abiding nation that Malawi is, and that we are very thankful for, and also thankful to the Malawian nation, Malawian people, to give them a reasonable time to move.
What is a reasonable time? Because the government has welcomed these refugees for years and years and years in Malawi. So when you say reasonable time, should they give 2, 3, 4 years? Because reasonable time, some will argue, might not necessarily work for the government based on the concerns of insecurity, among other issues they raised.
So a reasonable time, like I said, it can be 6 months, 12 months. That is reasonable. So the refugees, in essence, are not asking for 12 years or anything like that. They are asking for 6 to 12 months, or even more if it's possible. And the issue of security, the security issue that was raised, was actually for the refugees. They were saying that, okay, we cannot protect these refugees when they are not in the camp. But up till now, we have never received, even the government has never received any formal complaint from the refugees themselves, saying that they feel insecure, that they would feel more secure in the camp.
Eli Umukunzi is a Malawian-based businessman and a former refugee. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Somalia's cargo and travel industry has welcomed the resumption of diplomatic ties with neighbor Kenya after a five-month freeze that damaged trade. For VOA, Mohamed Kahiye reports from the Somali capital Mogadishu, tensions remain over an unresolved maritime territorial dispute.
Somalia and Kenya have announced the resumption of their diplomatic ties following mediation brokered by Qatar. Speaking to the media in Mogadishu, the Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Mohamed Abdul Razak, said Nairobi has agreed not to interfere in the domestic affairs as a condition.
Siyaasadda arrimaha dibadda Somalia inay tahay mid aan ogolayn faragelin.
The minister said the foreign policy of Somalia does not tolerate domestic affairs interference. He added, respect for sovereignty, no interference into internal political affairs, and borders are the foundations of the African Union principles. As the two neighboring states are working on new diplomatic engagement, various businesses have been affected during the diplomatic tension. Among them is Somalia's travel, tourism, and cargo sector. Ali Ahmed Farah is the manager of Idil Travel and General Services in Mogadishu. He confirms a five-month break in the relations reduced the travel between Somalia and Kenya. Farah says before Somalia severed diplomatic ties with Kenya, there were five or six daily direct flights between Mogadishu and Nairobi, but the number has been reduced to one or two. He added that the passengers they serve also face immense visa restrictions due to the closure of diplomatic missions. Somalia's government's ban on Kenyan flights carrying the milled narcotic drug cart has remained in place since March of last year, while Kenyan farmers still count the losses. At the same time, Somali cargo business operators face challenges from the Kenyan authorities. Mahmoud Jama from Easyway Cargo says business has dropped in the past 5 months. Since the two countries engaged in diplomatic dispute, the few airlines transiting Mogadishu-Nairobi route rejected to offer cargo services for fear of consequences from the immigration officials. He said they hope business will improve after the announcement of new relations when the two neighbors will lift restrictions. Qatar's special envoy for mediation of conflict resolution, Mutlaq Al-Qahtani, met with officials from both countries in an effort to repair relations. But Kenya and Somalia still have issues to resolve. The biggest being a dispute over maritime energy rights. The case was filed in 2014 by Somalia at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, the United Nations' highest court for disputes between states. And a decision could determine the rights to exploit oil and gas deposits in the deep waters of the East African coastline. Adan Makina, a doctoral student at Walden University in the United States, says it's hard to tell how the ICJ might deal with the case.
These are two neighboring countries who have had political altercations for a long time. Between 1935 and 1945, the two colonial powers of Italy and Britain could not resolve this maritime dispute, and they decided to leave it the way it is. How the two nations can agree is hard to tell.
In March, Kenya refused to participate in ICJ hearings about the dispute, citing alleged bias by the court. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
2016, that one thing. Na yule wadago wata kupigisha makoneti. Yule wakahawa takuacha sawa. Aki kudanganya kila hour. You're his only lover. Na yule wama jay, always on the day. Na yule waruai, always I and I. He'll never give you time, don't you see the signs? But it's all a lie.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impu, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, an anthill that is destined to become a giant anthill will ultimately become one, no matter how many times it is destroyed by elephants. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.